This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. This is episode 535, I think. 535. There you go. It's been a good week. We are in the midst of a changeover in administration in the department that I work with at my major client. And that all seems to be going smoothly. I got tickled on Monday. I got an email about 1:30, and the email said that the present administrator and the new administrator that were coming in were taking a half an hour to meet with different individuals, and would I be available to meet with them? And they had a slot available at 2:00. And would I be interested in coming for that slot? And of course, I replied immediately, I'll take the 2:00 slot, 2:00 slot. So I just printed off a discovery document that I'd done 5 years ago. Discovery document, just kind of refreshed myself on it a little bit, printed out multiple copies and went over, and we had a lovely meeting and, talked honestly about some issues, and I thought it was very profitable. I had already started, kind of some other conversations because I had talked to the executive over the entire department that week as well as part of this changeover, and he had expressed some concerns, and so we pursued some of those concerns, and that all looks like it's going to work out well. I mean, we're going to make some internal reconfigurations and try to adopt some other methodologies for accomplishing some things. We're going to, in another part of the programming system support area, they've been doing the sprint methodology. And that seems to be working out really well for them. And so we're going to attempt to adopt that methodology within the core group that I'm working with, and just kind of going over the basics of it. It looks like it's going to be something that's going to be really, really helpful. For one thing, it's going to relieve me of some of the administrative responsibilities, so that I can just focus on doing what I do. I think that's going to be really good. So, because there has been some overhead in some of the responsibilities that I've had, and with the relieving of that overhead, I think we can get back to a little more level of productivity that I usually enjoy. So, anyway, so that's good. The writing is going along fine. I got all the files, finished getting the files all uploaded. For book 10, got the books ordered. So that's all fine. We got tickled because I wasn't really... I send books to a couple of friends that I told them years ago, you're on my free book list. And one of the friends, I didn't think she was really reading them, but I posted that I was going to have book 10. You know, I'd ordered the copies of it, and she wrote me back. She said, geez, Phil, I haven't even had a chance to read the ones you've sent me so far. So it's just like, we just keep buttering along. Anyway, so that's fun. What else? Oh, I'm back. So now that I have the files for book 10 uploaded, I'm doing a read through this week of what I had written already on book 11. That seems to be going fine. I'm dressing up a few of the sections, kind of punching them up a little bit. So far I think it's a good start, and we'll keep going and we'll see what happens. I probably have maybe another 200 pages to read over this weekend. And then come Monday, I theoretically begin the next sprint. Probably be great, since I work on a weekly basis, probably would be good if I was actually ready to start that on Sunday. But, you know, if I don't get to it, that's fine too. And in the process of reading through what I have now, I would imagine that I will accrue, because I'm always adding little things here and there, thickening out descriptions, intensifying scenes. I'll imagine I'll have at least 2,000 or 3,000 words that I will have added to the book by the time I do that. And that's really the load for Sunday. And so then I'm good to go on Monday for my potential 10,000 words next week. But I'm at 95,000 words already in this book. And these books are really only supposed to go to about 150. And I'm on target for that. It feels like I've gotten the balls up in the air. They're starting to come down. I need to catch them all. I thought I was actually going to get farther in this book than I am, but that's okay. As it turns out, it's going to work out really well, because not this book, but next book is halfway to the 24, and it's halfway through the second set of 8 books. And if I do what I think I'm going to do now, that's going to end at a nice place. You know, it's going to kind of be a good place to, ta-da, you know, here we go. And it's going to kind of be, well, I don't know if I want to say that. So, it'll be a good halfway point. Let's put it that way. What it will be, what you would kind of expect out of a halfway point. You know, it's like kind of like Wednesday. So anyways, so that's all well and good. Aside that, everything's fine. I haven't had any reoccurrences of my kind of weird global transient amnesia incidents. I haven't had any recurrences of that today. I did have a doctor's appointment today that I went to and talked to my doctor, because they wanted me to get an MRI, and she had all the information from the emergency room visit. And so we talked for a little bit. They drew some blood because she wanted to check my cholesterol levels, you know, which I expect to be good. I didn't realize, it was funny because I didn't realize they were drawing blood today, and she said, okay, so now have you been fasting? And I kind of looked at her like, how did you know I've been fasting? I said, well, yeah. I said, I'm getting close to completing my 40 hours of fast, my second 40 hours of fasting. And she said, oh, you fast, and then we got to talk about that. As it turns out, I think they were probably supposed to tell me that I was supposed to fast, and nobody did, but that worked out fine, because I had been fasting, so. And the last time I actually saw her, I was doing the bulletproof coffee, and so I was putting butter and coconut oil in my coffee, so my saturated fats were a little high in my blood. She said, they're not that high, she said, but you might just watch that a little bit. I haven't been doing that now for years, so I would imagine my saturated fat level is probably going to come down a little bit, but we'll see. So they took blood, and that was fine, and everything was fine, and they did schedule me for an MRI. I was actually surprised how fast it was. I called up my wife after I got out of the doctor's office, and I said, well, I have a date tomorrow night. She said, oh. I said, yeah. 6:50, I have to be down at the MRI place, so I'll probably just wander down there. I'm wearing some crazy socks this time, because when I went in for a colonoscopy, I had worn some socks, but they weren't really that crazy of socks. And then I found out I could have kept my socks on. So I'm wearing crazy socks this time. I don't know exactly what pair, but I'll find a pair. I do have some cool socks I'm wearing tomorrow. They're Mr. Wavy socks. You know, the thing that they use, the fans, the big plastic things that wave. I've got some Mr. Wavy socks. I may just wear those tomorrow night as well, because they're pretty cool. Anyways, so that's news from Lake Wobegon. Everything is puttering along. Writing good, work good, family good, 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 good. Weather's been beautiful. Starting to warm up, but that's okay. That is okay. We like the warm weather too. Today, I came across what is supposedly the hardest logic puzzle ever. And I will admit that I had to read through this article a couple of times to go, what? In fact, I was reading through this article while I was waiting for the doctor today. I was reading through it again going, okay, get your brain around this, get your brain around this. There was a time in my life when I really loved logic puzzles. And in fact, I read some of the books, at least I read a book, who was written by the man that they talk about at the beginning of this article. And so I was a little bit familiar with this type of logic, and I've logic puzzles, and I had done some, but I gotta tell you, I don't think I would have ever gotten to the answer, because I wouldn't have enough patience to do so at this point in my life, because I have other things to do. But it was so clever. It was so clever that I thought, I should talk about this. Because there are ramifications, I think, to the fact that these type of logic puzzles even exist. I think it says something about us as human beings. So I'm going to do my best to describe this. If I don't do as good a job as the article, I'll just point you to the article and you can go read it for yourself and see if you can decipher it from there. The name of the article, which I believe was published on Nautilus, which I think is nautilus.us, Nautilus, was called How to Solve the Hardest Logic Puzzle Ever. And this was by Brian Gallagher. And it's pretty interesting. But he set it up with something else that was very interesting to me. He talks about the fact that a man named Raymond Smullyan. Raymond Smullyan. S-M-U-L-L-Y-A-N. He was studying under a founder of theoretical computer science, and he was a doctoral student at Princeton University in 1957. He said he'd occasionally go to New York City. So on one of these visits, he met a, quote, very charming lady musician. And on their first date, Smullyan, an incorrigible flirt, proceeded very logically and sneakily. He asked, would you please do me a favor? I am to make a statement. If the statement is true, would you give me your autograph? Content to play along, she replied, I don't see why not. If the statement is false, he went on, you don't give me your autograph. All right, she replied. His statement was, you will give me neither your autograph nor a kiss. All right, so so the guy goes on and says, it takes a moment, the author of the article, but the cleverness of Smullyan's ploy eventually becomes clear. A truthful statement gets him her autograph as they agreed. But Smullyan's statement, supposing it's true, leads to a contradiction. it rules out giving an autograph. So if she gives him an autograph, it makes the statement untrue. Therefore, she cannot give him the autograph. But if she doesn't give him the autograph, that makes the first part of the statement true. And so, in order to make the statement false, because she isn't going to give him an autograph, she needs to give him a kiss. Got it? Because if she doesn't give him a kiss, and she doesn't give him an autograph, then his statement is true, and she should give him an autograph, because he said, "You will give me neither an autograph nor a kiss." So now you see the trap. She has already agreed not to reward a false statement with an autograph. And the article goes on. With logic, Simoleon turned a false statement into a kiss and into a beautiful romance. The two would eventually marry. Now, there are several things about this that I find highly interesting and even astonishing. The first one is that this musician, and I'm not saying, I don't care whether she's male or female, this musician could actually follow the logic of that. Because musicians, unless they're analytical musicians, which apparently she was, aren't necessarily known for their analytical skills. Second of all, that she found this charming, which she apparently did, and was amused by the fact that she had been tricked into giving him a kiss. I find that interesting as well. I also find it interesting that she didn't file sexual harassment charges against him. I'm getting my mail. But most interesting of all, I find this situation that this has been published 42 years later, because it happened in 1957. Yes, 42 years later. I find most interesting that while this has been published in 42 years later, that some on the liberal left have not taken him to task for his obvious sexual harassment of this woman, and they have not burned him in effigy, and they have not demanded that his books be taken down and that he be branded a misogynist and be forever shamed in the Hall of Patriotic Males. So, but somehow, Simoleon has escaped all of those things. And he remains a beloved figure in logical puzzles like these. Because he did write a couple of books. And as I said, I did have the opportunity to read one of them. And of the books that he had read, that he had written, one was called To Mock a Mockingbird. And I read that one, but there was another one called What is the Name of This Book? Which is fun. So anyways, thankfully the man, you know, has passed on at this point, but that doesn't even seem to protect people any longer from being posthumously and in absentia crucified because they dared to flirt. So over the course of his life, Simoleon, 96, became an accomplished pianist and magician, made fundamental contributions to modern logic and wrote about Taoist philosophy and chess. He is the undisputed master of logic puzzles, Bruce Horowitz, one of his former PhD students, has said. One mark of Simoleon's legacy is the interest philosophers and logicians still have in his most difficult puzzle, known as the hardest logic puzzle ever. The title was given by a philosopher of logic at Mathematics Institute of Technology, a colleague of Simoleon's named George Boulos, B-O-O-L-O-S, who, no slouch himself, adored logic challenges of all sorts. He once tested himself by giving a lecture on Gödel's second incompleteness theorems, one of the most important results in modern logic, using only single syllable words. yeah, you gotta love these guys. Anyway, so here we go. It's at the end of a week of work, so let's see if I can get this done. So the hardest logic puzzle ever goes like this. Three gods, G-O-D, little g, A, B, and C are called in some order true, false, and random. So they're called true, false, and random. True always speaks truly. False always speaks falsely. But whether random speaks truly or falsely is a completely random matter. Your task is to determine the identities of A, B, and C by asking three yes-no questions. Each question must be put to exactly one god. The gods understand English, but will answer all questions in their own language, in which the words for yes and no are da and ja in some order. You do not know which word means which. So there you go. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have... No, I'm just joking. Woo! Okay. So here we go. So Boulos, the author said he took a crack at it, and he eventually just went, okay, yeah, never mind. I'm going to roll down the windows because I am in the garage at this point, and it's a little warm in here, and I definitely don't need to be sleepy while I'm trying to do this. All right. Okay, so here we go. So he said the first thing that Boulos tells us, I have no idea who those people are. That was a call that was coming in on my phone, although I would guess it's probably the MRI center because it was a 0000 number. So I would imagine it's Cox. I will get back to them in a little bit. So the first thing that Boulos tells us in this is that don't make the mistake of crafting your questions all at once, hoping that the assume and deduce strategy would pay off. Instead, the first thing you must do is figure out a question that will identify who random can't be. This is so clever. Goodness, this is clever. Or who can only be either true or false. This is so clever. This will, by process of elimination, help you reveal the identity of random. And once you've identified random, it's easy to work exposing the other two. Okay, so first of all, what they build up from is you take random out of the picture, first of all. And you just see what the characteristics are of the old classic knights and knave riddles, which the knight always tells you the truth, the knave always tells you falsehoods. And so how do you craft a question that you can get the answer you want from either a knight or a knave, even though you don't know who is who? And the answer to that, I learned it as something like, if I were to ask you such and such and such, what would you tell me? Because that works with double positives and it works with double negatives. In this case, the author here, Mboulos, talks about crafting a biconditional statement. And by a biconditional statement, what you're really doing is you're multiplying the logical equivalent of the output of the first statement with the output of the second statement. And in this case, this type of multiplication is more like multiplying not ones and zeros, but ones and minus ones. So if true is a one, false is a minus one. And so if you can craft the statement in such a way that you can get a multiplication between the two conditions, then one multiplied by one is still one, negative one multiplied by negative one because is still one. Okay, so in this case, if you were trying to find out if Pluto is a dwarf planet and you had forgotten, you would say to the knight, if you are a knight, you would say to the knight, are you a knight if and only if Pluto is a dwarf planet? And so if Pluto is a dwarf planet and you're talking to a knight, the knight would say yes. Because if the person's a knight and Pluto is a dwarf planet, then you get the answer yes, since both statements on each side of the if and only if are true, and knights only speak the truth. If the person's a knight and Pluto is not a dwarf planet, you get no. Because since the question contains a false statement. If the person is a knave and Pluto is a dwarf planet, you get yes, since knaves always speak falsely, and the correct answer is no, so they can't say no since they're a knave, so they say yes. And if the person's a knave and Pluto is not a dwarf planet, you get no, since the correct answer is yes. Okay, so that's one. All right. But you can do basically the same thing to find out the da and the ja simply by asking, since you know that if you do a biconditional, you're going to normalize the answers to yes and no. If you know the answer to the second half, you can figure out the answer to the first half. So if you say something like, does da mean yes if and only if Pluto is a dwarf planet? Okay, so if you get da and you've asked if da means yes and you know that Pluto is a dwarf planet, then you immediately can figure out whether da is yes, or ja is yes. Okay, so you get an answer. Wait, what? Oh, if you don't know whether Pluto is a dwarf planet, at least you get the same answer from both of them, depending on what Pluto is. So, and that becomes important later. So not knowing whether the person is a knight or a knave wasn't an obstacle, so neither is not knowing da and ja. Because the condition that you're looking for will result in da if the statement is true and ja if the statement is false. Okay. So, I'm paraphrasing some of this, okay? You need to find out whether Pluto is a dwarf planet, and you have to ask someone who could either be a knight or a knave, and he'll only respond in da or ja. What questions would you ask? If you think that since this is a compound puzzle, the right thing to ask is a compound question, you'd be right. Ask, does da mean yes, if and only if you're a knight, and if and only if Pluto is a dwarf planet? In this case, then, you would get da if Pluto is a dwarf planet, and ja if it's not, regardless of whether you're addressing a knight or knave. That well-crafted question is like the lock's key. So by that, you have then deciphered that da is yes and ja is no. Okay? Okay, now this next stuff. I had to read this multiple times. But man, is it clever. Okay, so then you need a third piece. And the third piece really isn't so much about deciphering an answer as excluding a possibility. So in this one, these are the rules. The person places in front of you three cards in a row, face down. There are two aces and a jack. You don't know the order, but the person does who placed them face down. The rule is that if you happen to point at one of the two aces, the person will answer truthfully like a knight. But if you happen to point at a jack instead, the person will answer yes or no at random like the random god. And your job is to find one of the aces. Got two aces. One jack. If you point at the jack, the person might answer yes, they might answer no. If you point at an ace, the person will answer truthfully. So the author says, this one may seem slightly trickier, but really it's not. Point to any card and ask if one of the other cards is an ace. Let's say you point to the middle card and ask whether the left card is an ace. Bolo says, whether the middle card is an ace or not, you are certain to find an ace by choosing the left card if the person says yes, and choosing the right card if the person says no. And this is where it gets tricky. Why? Well, if the middle card is an ace, then when I say yes, the left card is also an ace, because the question was asked, is this an ace while pointing at the middle card? So if the left card is an ace, the person has to answer truthfully if the card you're pointing at is the random one. But if the card you're pointing at, no, is an ace. Sorry. Let me back up. Let me say that one more time. When you say, is the left card an ace? And the answer, yes, you've got a couple of possibilities. If you're pointing at the middle card and the middle card is an ace, the person is going to tell you the truth. And so the response to, is the left card an ace? If that's yes, then the left card is an ace. If that's no, then the right card is an ace, because you're pointing at an ace. But if the card you're pointing at is the random card, you have no idea whether it's going to be yes or no, but it doesn't matter because there's only one random card. There's only one jack. So the fact that you're pointing at the random jack card means that you can just pick either card and you can arbitrarily decide that if he says yes, you're going to pick the left one, and if he says no, you're going to pick the right one. And it doesn't matter, because either way, you're going to hit one of the aces. So you're not really concerned about the absolute minutiae of the answer at that point. You're simply concerned about the fact that since there is only one possibility of random answers, you can formulate those answers into the larger possibility of whether you have someone who's actually acting as a knight and always telling you the truth. So those two answer stacks can fold into each other and get you to your objective. Okay. So, woo! All right. So now then, the first question that you're going to ask these three gods is really to determine which ones are not random. Which one you want to exclude one from being random. I hope I said that right. Okay. And that's all the first question is doing. You have no idea what Ja and Da means. You have no idea who is true and false. You don't care. You're simply trying to deal with the problem of identifying who is not random. Okay, so here we go. So let's pose the question, and I would have never got this. Holy cow. So let's pose the question to God A and assert that B is random. So the question is, does Da mean yes if and only if you are true, if and only if B is random? This is the equivalent of pointing at B while asking about the identity of A, just like we just did with the cards. In the card puzzle, whether or not I answer truthfully or randomly, you can depend on my yes or no response to find an ace with certainty. The same applies here. No matter, quote, no matter whether A is true, false, or random, says Bolos, if you get the answer Da, then C is either true or false. And if you get the answer Ja, then B is either true or false. Let's suppose we got Ja. And I could take some time explaining that, but it really does make sense if you work your way down to it and you, yes, because you can, okay, so if you're asking if B is random, let's see if I can get this. If you're asking if B is random and you're asking A that question, there's only a couple of possibilities. A could be true or false. And in those possibilities of true or false, if A is true, then it means that B might be false or random. That makes everything false. And so therefore, A will answer Ja, because you've asked if B is true in the question. Da is true in the question. In the case of false, if A is false, it means that you're going to get Ja as well. If B is not random. And so in the case of A being true or false, you're always going to get Ja. In the case of B being either true or false. And you're going to get the case that C, da, will either be true or false if the answer is da, because you're dealing with absolute conditions in A. If A is random and you have no idea whether or not they're answering correctly, it doesn't matter, because in that case, you can pick either B or C as someone who is not random, and the rest of it will work out. Okay, so the rule is you're just going to pick Ja. If the answer is Ja, you're going to pick B. If the answer is Da, you're going to pick C. So now you move to the next step. So let's say we get a Ja. So that means that either A is true or false or random, but B is either true or false. And we know that. So then you ask B, does Ja mean yes if and only if Pluto is a dwarf planet? We know that Pluto is in fact a dwarf planet. There are only two possible responses. If B is true, you get the answer Da. If B is false, you get the answer Ja. Since the answer is correctly Da, and false always speaks falsely. Okay, now you have one of the gods identified as either true or false. And the rest of it plays out. Doesn't matter whether they're true or false. So we'll just assume that they're true. So B is true. Now then, the god true. All right. So then now we're going to ask true, your third and final question. Does Da mean yes if and only if A is random? Given that random must be able either A or C, there's only one possible response. Since B is true, you get Da, which means A is random, and therefore C is false. So to recap, employing all three of Boulos's logic, our three questions to determine whether this god is true, false, or random go like this. To god A, does Da mean yes if and only if you are true, and if and only if B is random? Okay? Then, because you got a Ja instead of a Da, you go to god B. Does Da mean yes if and only if Pluto is a dwarf planet? We're going to assume that Da means yes, making B true. And then then you would go to the true god, whichever it was. Because if you got Ja, then it would mean that that A is true, I think. Yeah, maybe. And then to god B, true again. Does Da mean yes if and only if A is random? And since if B says true, he says Da, which means A is random, leaving C to false. If he says Ja, it means that A is false, leaving that. Okay, it's interesting because he says, so what does the hardest logic puzzle ever teach us? According to Boulos, it shows us how essential one of the supposed fundamental laws of logic, the law of excluded middle, seems to be. Quote, our ability to reason about alternate possibilities, says Boulos, even in everyday life, would be completely paralyzed were we to be denied the use of the law of the excluded middle. The law of the excluded middle is simply this. Every statement is either true or false. There is no middle ground. That's a sobering thought. But we have only Simoleon, that most devilish of puzzlers, Only have to thank Simoleon, that most devilish of pillars, for making us ponder it with such edifying delight. Okay, so what? So what? Well, first of all, it's fascinating. It's just fascinating to me that we as humans, that supposedly arose through such chaos and seemingly without any design at all, could craft such intricate, beautiful, transcendent things. I mean, there is a purity, a completeness to that type of puzzle that rests on the fact that there is an ideal that exists beyond our shady, questionable lives. I mean, people who look at life on Earth, people who look at the behavior of humans always come away with this idea that there is, humanity is conflicted and there's shades of gray and it's all this big mishmash and everything is relative. And yet, even though we see that in humanity, very plainly we see that in humanity, humanity is nonetheless capable of imagining and operating in worlds that are pristine, like mathematics. Mathematics, which is unreasonably efficient in our world. Unreasonably effective. And in addition to that, we have this ability to craft these logic puzzles that are pure, that somehow we can set aside all of our ambiguities and all of our shadings, and we can imagine a world where there is the principle of the excluded middle. That in our language that we have crafted for ourselves, that we have been given, that was created for us, whatever, in our language, that we actually have an embedded principle of purity, that statements are either true or false. And that's really fascinating to me because it hearkens to something that is beyond our grimy, shaded, relative existence. You know, people like to harp about the fact that morality is not set and it's all situational, it's this, that, and the other. And yet, right at the base of our communication, we have this feeling, we have this necessity that our communication is classified and can only be comprehended if, in fact, we have the implicit and explicit understanding that statements are either true or false. They're either right or wrong. And that's really interesting. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.